This is the happiness quotient. For a free PDF download of A Course in Happiness, go to patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, or if it's more convenient, check it out on my website at eyesopenproductions.com/happiness. And I welcome your thoughts and ideas too on your happiness quotient.
All of my wisdom came from all the toughest days. I never learned a thing being happy. All of my suffering came, I didn't appreciate it. I never learned a thing being happy.
I'm Tom Pollard, and welcome to the Happiness Quotient. This is an episode about soul. If there ever was a person fitting the essence of the Happiness Quotient, it's this gentleman, Seth Walker. He's our guest today. The Happiness Quotient exists purely to inspire people to follow their heart, to listen to the song of their soul. Literally and figuratively, Seth Walker, an American blues guitarist, singer, songwriter, author, poet, painter, has followed the song of his soul.
Here I sit in this hotel bar, jukebox playing low, whiskey in my glass, worries all I know.
He learned a classical instrument early in life, taught by his parents, and in college became so enamored, obsessed with the guitar and learning the blues licks of musicians like T-Bone Walker, to name one, that he literally dropped out of college to go as deep as he could into the world of being a musician. There's only so many hours in the day, and Seth wanted to devote every one of those hours of each day to learning how to play the blues like a real blues master. Seth has a new book out. It's about his life. It's called Your Van is on Fire. And that's a great story he tells within his book about the van catching fire. It's a memoir of sorts. It includes a wonderful array of short stories about his life, his early life, poems and paintings, photographs of paintings.
Home again. I've been so long since I've been home again. Oh, it's been so long.
He's more than the sum of his parts. His music is captivating, soulful, beautiful, bright, and insightful. Sometimes deep, or in the instance of his song Inside, it can be dense. That's his word. Written about a trip to Cuba in 2016, right after the death of Fidel Castro. We'll play that song later. I learned about Seth by way of his publicist, Kevin Calabro of Calabro Music Media. Kevin is also the publicist for the Wood Brothers, among other fine bands. Seth has no less than 10 albums. He's a real road warrior, has been touring for years and years. His albums Gotta Get Back and Leap of Faith went high on the Billboard Blues album charts, number 6 and number 2 respectively. Not too shabby, Seth.
Take me home again.
Today we're going to share a ton of Seth's music and weave it into a revealing, soulful interview that I did with Seth just a short while back. And we'll talk a lot about his book and how it came to be, which probably wouldn't have happened had it not been for his touring schedule being shut down due to COVID. What's new, right? What seems to be happening, at least here with the interview subjects I've had on the Happiness Quotient, is that musicians have lost a ton of touring time and income, but creative types that they are, they've had a chance to pour themselves back into their craft, their art, their muse. That's how Seth's book, Your Van is on Fire, came to be. You want to know the world of a musician rising up through the ranks? This is a treasure for you. if it helped Seth. He said he was on a spinning, flaming hamster wheel. It gave him time to reflect and write. I'm going to read you the liner notes of the book. Your Van Is On Fire is a riotous and charming melange of a touring musician's meandering life. Part memoir, part meditation, part art gallery, it sheds light on the ins, outs, and what have yous of life inside the mind and van of an artist. The collection includes short essays, poems, and paintings, capturing Walker's early years growing up in a musical family on a Quaker commune, to his discovery of the blues guitar of T-Bone Walker and his coming of age as an artist. The book centers on his life making music in the Southern Love Triangle of Austin, Nashville, and New Orleans, and includes some hilarious, contemplative, and wild tales from the driver's seat of the van and other random locales. So jump on in, go for a ride, bring matches and a fire extinguisher. You will need both.
Call me what you will, but I know that I can see what love can do.
After some pleasantries and telling a couple of Willie Nelson stories, how I personally met Willie and how Seth played at some Willie shows, Seth told me first about growing up on a Quaker commune. Let's hear our conversation, interspersed with his fine music and a reading or two from his book.
Well, you know, I guess this was probably I was born in 72. So around that time, my parents, Scott and Carol Walker, met this other couple, Jim and Susan Walton. And they just became buds. They actually met at this place called Quaker Lake, which is a little retreat in North Carolina. And they were just buds. And, you know, when I say Quaker, Tom, please, it's you know, Amish is serious, you know, Quaker, heavy-duty Quaker. It was more of like a loose lifestyle than it was hardcore Quaker. I think the thing that my father resonated with it was the meditative part of it, because it's a lot of silence. There's no preacher or anything like that. So my father's always been into Eastern philosophy things. So he was like, man, this is pretty cool. There's nobody saying anything. I can dig this. And so they just... It just kind of organically happened that they decided to build this log house together. So they built this thing, and I think they started in around about the time I was born. Yeah, around 73, I think they started. Mm. And we moved in there in 1975, and we lived there communally, nine of us, for 13 years. That's how I kind of got. That's what I knew growing up. We had about 15 acres of land, and I mean, we're talking about serious hippies, man. I'm talking about, like, you know, I mean, it was, yeah,
yeah.
A lot of Willie Nelson records were playing, yeah.
So that's appealing and very, very cool. So it's like this. Yeah. It's like a commune, kind of. I don't know if that's a derogatory word.
Yeah, it was a commune. I mean, we had chickens, and they were, you know, we were sharing the chores, and I mean, hell, they even shared money, which seems insane. I can't imagine that. And trying to navigate that, you know, and all the needs, wants, and desires of everyone, and it really, you know, looking back on it, you know, it seems so natural growing up. I really personally, I couldn't imagine trying to do that as an adult.
Yeah. So your parents obviously seem really, really cool. Are both your parents still alive now?
Yeah, they're both alive. They're both great musicians. My father, a cellist, guitar player, pianist, composer. My mother plays violin. My sister plays violin. Mm. And they're everybody's healthy. They're doing great. Actually, in the last couple albums, we finally got together and they collaborated with me on one of my albums and played some string parts with me, which was a real What a treat that was for me.
Oh, that is so cool. So you obviously fell in love with with music and the impact it had on you. And you obviously then as well showed quite the talent for playing the guitar and other instruments. And how on earth does someone go from just loving music and me like just kind of hacking away at a guitar, turn it into a real professional kind of dream? Because there are a lot of damn good musicians out there who just, you know, sleep on couches and eat dirt for their entire lives, you know? So it's a pretty big, like a big leap of faith to say, this is who I am. I'm going to do it come hell or high water, good times and bad.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, growing up with the classical music, I will be the first to tell you that I didn't have the passion for it. It wasn't like a total complete bummer, but it was, and it wasn't taught with an iron fist either. It was just what we did.
Yeah.
And I mean, I did enjoy parts of it, but it wasn't until college where these guys were playing electric. They were playing Stevie Ray Vaughan, Clapton, Hendrix. And when when I picked up the guitar, like there was something, it was something that I found. It was something that I discovered that maybe it just, and I think just the that blues thing and the way, you know, how improvisational it was and how much of a feeling that it was. Not that classical music doesn't have feeling, but it's not written on a page. It's all by feel. And that's kind of how I grew up, because this was a very organic kind of a, lots of moving parts, and you'd have to kind of improvise in how you lived your life with nine people. So maybe that somehow stems into why I kind of resonated with improvisational music.
Right on.
That's, I just remember vividly, Tom, like when I could bend a string. You can't bend a cello string, you know. it's hard to do.
It's like, ah. Yeah.
And then I was, to get back to your question or your comment, it wasn't even a decision that I made or any kind of epiphany that I had that I wanted to do this for the rest of my life. It was just, I just did it. I just tunnel vision. It's probably good that I didn't think too much about it.
Yeah. No, that's if you did, then it's not really happening. It's kind of like this idea that when people want something, they find themselves in the state of wanting something, as opposed to having this essence in your heart and soul and just going to it, as opposed to like trying to get too much. You put the thinking in it and it screws the whole thing up. It's like, I want to be enlightened. And so there you are in the state of wanting to be enlightened. It's just, it.
There you go. It don't work. It don't work that way, man. It's so funny, man. Really just surrender to it. I mean, there's been many times, obviously through the process, where I have tried to grab it and steer it and white knuckle it, and it always comes back to bite me on the ass, because that's not the way the muse works. It's not the way creativity works.
That, oh man, that is just so right on what you, the muse. And so what is the muse? I know this is like, sometimes there are no words for it, but what is the muse? What is your muse? And man, what?
Well, it's definitely something that it's something that I don't own. It's not mine. It's really, you know, just trying to be a conduit for it, to be open enough to let it come through. And you know, and as you grow and as you try and fail and try. And, you know, that muse changes some, for sure. Just like, obviously, with the book, I'd been playing music my whole life, and all of a sudden the world stopped and I'm staring out the window asking some serious questions. And, you know, the muse just kind of redirected, somehow, thankfully, redirected my spirit towards a new form.
A finer love there could not be. It was right in front of me. I was searching up around the bend, was looking out instead of looking in, and I've drifted. Yes, I've drifted.
The muse, it's almost like some people would call it God or source or something like that, or divine inspiration. That's really beautiful. You just become a conduit to, because it's like we're all connected to something greater than who we are, at least as an individual. Maybe communally we can be truly great and more perfect, and you know, but yeah, it's like,
yeah, it's an interesting concept. Elizabeth Gilbert did a great TED talk about it, and she was talking about, you know, they call it like the genius. It's like a, you know, in African cultures they call it the spirit, you know, or God, like a genius, and the genius would come through. And it really started to get screwed up when you started to call someone a genius, because, you know, you can't be a genius. It's like, plus that's a lot of pressure.
Well, yeah, and that's where the power and the intoxication with one's own, you know, superiority, and that, you know, why people, you know, I've always been very uncomfortable. Well, when I was a kid, I looked up to rock stars and musicians and stuff like that. But when people begin to put, say, a leader of a religion or even of a church, in a way, on some sort of pedestal that makes him or her greater than just an average person, man, the power, it Ooh. Doesn't work.
Love that leads me home, back to the place I belong. I've drifted. I've lost my way. I've lost my way. I've lost my way. Coming home today. Gotta get back.
This is Gotta Get Back, title track off Seth's 2016 album. It was produced by the Wood Brothers drummer and keyboardist, the multi-talented Jano Ricks. No doubt some deep experience and wisdom in these words, but Seth didn't just pick up the guitar and write a song magically. He practiced, he put the hours in, he sweated it out, fell in love with the sound of the blues. So just in kind of the pragmatic, practical aspect of it, when you were first learning, say, guitar, did you lock yourself in your room and practice, you know, 8 hours a day? I mean, because it seems like a lot of people go through that.
Yeah, I did at the beginning. I was just, it's all I did. I dropped out of college. You know, I made the call to my parents. And I literally sat around my dorm room and I just played blues, played along with blues records. My uncle was pretty instrumental in some of the early development, because he had a radio show down in Jacksonville, Florida, called the After Hours Cafe, and it was a blues program, and he played, oh man, all like Piedmont stuff, Blind Willie McTell, Blind Blake, you know, on to Texas, T-Bone and Gatemouth and Lightning Hopkins and Mance Lipscomb and Chicago. He would play all these different, you know, genre or areas of blues, and he would send me these tapes, and I would just sponge them, man. And that really, those seeds were really the kind of, it sprouted me to go to Austin, because I knew I wanted to be in, you know, in some rich soil out there, that where this stuff comes from, or at least the version of the style of blues that I really resonated with. So to answer your question, yes, I played a lot of guitar in the early days. Yeah.
Damn. So how has COVID impacted you? Has it shut you down? Are you still just going forth, kind of doing other things? Like, you know, COVID just, it's a wallop, but it's like the creative juices don't stop. So for you personally, what's that been like for the last year?
Well, you know, it was obviously very, very shocking, and, you know, a shock to a system that I've been rolling with for, you know, last 15, 20 years, you know, just tour, and just, you know, just the whole perpetual feeling of it keeps me spinning. And so when the world stopped, the comfortableness of it remained, but there was I needed it. In other words, I actually needed it. I was on a spinning, flaming hamster wheel that I needed to stop.
Wow.
And yeah, so I think I wouldn't have been able to write this book if I didn't have the time to really just reflect on my life and different, you know, things that I would, shadows that I would bat back by just going back on the road. You can just kind of pretend like they don't exist, and I'll go do another gig. And so a lot of things, creatively and personally, that I needed to address. And this gave me the opportunity to do that. I'm not saying it was comfortable, obviously,
right,
because there's no, right, there, you know, the money was tough, and, you know, not making any income, and just, you know, trying to realign my, you know, my chi, as it were. And,
yeah,
but it worked out pretty good.
Yeah. So tell me about your book, Your Van Is on Fire. I love it. There's a lot of touching parts in it. So I don't mean to say it's just a funny book, but there were times I just, like, really, really laughed. I mean, you are no problem poking fun at yourself, and you know, and that's the best part. You're real. And Oliver Wood, your friend, he wrote the intro to it, and in it, yeah, he talks about how this book shows about you, that you bear your soul. It's obvious in your music, but and in the book now that I've read it. But so tell me about it, what the process was and what you were endeavoring to do when you put this artwork and poetry and prose together.
Well, it originally was not, it was, I had no grand scheme or plan to even write a book. I through the years, I would journal some from the road, and I would write little things, and I would do a little bit of poetry. I'm guessing, you know, obviously, poetry and songwriting are kind of, you know, somewhat in similar worlds, the brevity of it. But I went back to some of these early journals, these essays that I would write, and I had just a handful of them. And I was like, oh, man, these are kind of fun. And I just started, you know, just retracing some of my upbringing. And I've never really told my story. I've never written it down. And it just so happened, man, that my next door neighbor, her name is Leslie LaChance, She wrote a story about me in the East Nashvilleian. She's an amazing poet, writer herself. And she was my next door neighbor. And so I showed her a couple of my pieces. And she was like, wow, dude, you might have, you got some stuff here. And she became my editor for the whole project. So that was very instrumental in having someone to encourage me, have someone to tell me that I was barking up the wrong tree or maybe I had some bones of something there, but it wasn't fully developed. So that was instrumental. And then, dude, I just deepened it. I just started reading, you know, the classics. I started studying, how these essayists put it together. And I just found myself so creatively inspired without even trying. I don't know. It was so freeing not to be tied to a 3-minute song.
Mm.
You know, even though these are short essays.
Yeah.
For me, that's a long form. You know, 2 pages. I get to express myself in 2 pages.
You can get a lot so in.
I don't know, man. I felt there was no expectations about it. You know, I'm not a writer. I don't call myself a writer. It was pure muse, I reckon.
Let's read a little excerpt from Your Van Is on Fire. And you know, the problem with an excerpt is that it doesn't tell the whole story. This is a very touching book, full of love, full of this beautiful connection with his family and his friends. But it's also got some really funny instances. I'm going to read you this one excerpt from an essay of his called Southern Nights. And he had the privilege of playing with the musician, the New Orleans-based musician, Alan Toussaint, who passed in 2015. Among other songs, Alan Toussaint wrote Get Out of My Life, Woman, which was picked up on Paul Butterfield's second album. I actually have a YouTube video of Paul Butterfield's son performing that song with Jimmy Vivino, and it's smashing indeed. But Alan Toussaint, highly regarded musician, truly like one of those guys that you can't touch. Funny you should say can't touch. Let me read the first 2 paragraphs from this excellent essay. This is Seth writing now. There's a small group of artists that possess a certain aura, a je ne sais quoi, levitating them a few feet off the ground wherever they walk, floating. Alan Toussaint, the New Orleans piano player, singer, and songwriter, falls precisely into this category for me. The man was Americana royalty, prolific, imaginative, funky, soulful, touching, mysterious, sensitive, honest, and swinging. He left an everlasting mark on the world of music with his illustrious career. I had the distinct privilege to open 2 shows for him in New York City in the summer of 2012. I met him in the afternoon of our first performance down at the City Winery in the Lower West Side of Manhattan. He showed up for soundcheck in full suit, leisurely accented with sandals and white socks. His silvering hair was perfect. Mr. Toussaint spoke with slow, southern rhythmic diction and eloquence. We exchanged some laughs and thoughts about life, music, and New Orleans. As we were walking off the stage, I patted him on the shoulder, not thinking, all country bumpkin style. Nice to meet you and see you tonight, Mr. Toussaint. He looked at me calmly but sharply and said, "Don't touch the suit, my man." It seems I left quite a mark on him, but not the one I was intending. To that muse thing, you're expressing yourself, and that's what this book is. It's
it expresses something really beautiful in a lot of different forms in there.
And it's sprawling. It's sprawling. I'm kind of like that with my music. I've got so many different influences and different moods and different things. So I just kind of went with that same sprawling approach to this book, if you will.
Right on. I love it. In terms of your music, are you putting together an album now? Are you do you have any, you know, recording sessions or any kind of in its new form, doing any live performances or anything up?
I'm actually right in the middle of working on a new album. And I'm actually kind of close to getting it ready to be mixed. I kind of worked on it alongside with the book somehow. And it's funny, man. I guess when you do something long enough, it's easy to lose sight of why you started doing it in the first place. And so the book really kind of realigned me in some ways. It's kind of got me back into music again. I'm excited about music just as a contrast. It happened the same way with some of my artwork. I remember years ago, I was living in Austin, Texas. And the music business had beat me up so bad, dude. I was about to check out. And I just started painting. I painted for 3 months straight.
Seriously.
And it kind of realigned me to get back into music again. So the book has done a similar thing for me.
Do you put the guitar down sometime for a week and not touch it? Or are you like one of those guys, bam, you wake up in the morning and you reach for it and it's like a bring and maybe, oh, let's see if anything wants to speak to me.
It's pretty spiky. I don't have as much of a routine as I probably should, honestly. But yeah, I mean, they're laying around. You can see them there. I mean, I guess you're right. I'm always picking them up. But real quick, I just had a thought. I was just thinking back about how all three of those things, I keep kind of dancing around between them, art, writing now, and music. A lot of times it's just, if I get low, or I'm having, in this business, you can get spiky with your emotions and your ego and your fragility. I find myself, looking out the window sometimes and then the window's looking back at me. Asking some serious questions, and the artwork and the art is the only way that I've found that, provides me any kind of remedy for those feelings.
That's pretty awesome. Hey, I don't know if it would be putting you on the spot, but I love the story you told about when you drove up. You'd just gotten back from a tour or some time on the road, and your buddies urged you to drive up to go see Guy Clark at a small club in Austin,
Pooties.
I guess.
Pooties Hilltop.
Pooties Hilltop. And something, like, you were kind of actually, it sounds like you were kind of aggravated. Screw it, I guess. But there was some, if you used the word earlier in the epiphany thing, and there, something kind of happened and you when you least expect it. So can you share with me a little bit about that story?
Yeah. This was probably, probably the early 2000s. And I'm embarrassed to say that I was not familiar with Guy Clark's music at the time. I mean, alas. My friends told me about him playing out there. So I drove out there way outside of town. I was in a very crusty state coming off the road and I reluctantly did drive out there. And it was just such a, this Pootie's Hilltop, it's getting back to Willie. Pootie was Willie's tour manager forever. So this was his spot. And, Willie Nelson's studio's out there too, Pertinalis Studios, out in the hill country, about an hour west of Austin. And up jumps Guy Clark and Daryl Scott and Verlin Thompson. And I was just so, I've never been so schooled and so, like just a dagger. I mean, just a real epiphany to, it was just so potent. His lyric and his music was so potent to me. And just like, it completely threw me for a damn loop. And what the amazing thing about Guy Clark's music that I kind of discovered that night, I touched on briefly in the essay, was how accessible he could make it, how simple these sometimes complex feelings and images that he would portray, anybody from intellect to a ranch hand can get it.
So cool. So cool. And so, yeah. And so this got all of a sudden, boom, I got it. And you talk, in your essay that you wrote about I think the word soul, you felt that connection, like he was pouring his soul out. And that's you, man. That's like the your music is.
I mean, that's what we all try to do as artists, you know. He's definitely a guidepost as far as that goes. I mean, what a lifer. I mean, that probably was a very, you know, a big reason why I ended up moving to Nashville, because I started to listen to his music, and I started to listen to John Hiatt, and I listened to Nick Lowe and Jesse Winchester and all, and a lot of guys, Towns Van Zandt, of course, and Steve Earle. And that's why that's when I realized, you know, maybe after that trip to Pooties, where I was like, man, I need to submerge myself with some songwriters. So I was this guy, Gary Nicholson, a great songwriter, and he writes a lot in the blues world. And when I heard him play, he lived in Nashville, and he was playing blues with all these really great lyrics. He actually worked with Guy for a while, huh, and wrote a bunch of songs with Guy. And I was like, you know what? I think this was probably 2008 where I made the move to Nashville.
Cool.
Yeah. You know, at first I was just so wide open, and I was learning. I was just taking it all in and really writing with a bunch of different people. And then I found myself starting to, as we talked about earlier with the muse, starting to steer it. Mm. Like I was trying to calculate stuff, and like some of the songs I was writing, man, I didn't believe them. They might have been like crafty, or they might, you know, I was like, man, I don't even believe what I'm singing. And it really messed me up, man. And I ended up moving to New Orleans as a, as almost like to, because that city and that music culture is so raw. It is so not calculated. It is so pure. And so I almost went to New Orleans almost to unlearn I always felt like I was getting squeaky or something, squeaky clean. I was getting too polishy. That's why I moved to New Orleans.
All I need to know.
If somebody said, what is Seth Walker's music? You have your own sound. If my gut tells me that if any musician is after anything, it's originality, to be who he or she is. And you got that.
Thank you. That's my goal to as you go, you're constantly changing if with any luck. With any luck, you're changing and you're morphing,
evolving.
And I don't want to put out the same record every time. I'm a different person every time,
right?
You know, so I try to find that balance, you know, to step outside my comfort zone somewhat, step out to the skinny end of the branch, see if it'll hold me, and then all the while staying true to my sound or my place.
Mm.
It's a tricky little one. But I appreciate you saying, man, that's as artists, we want to, you listen to BB King. You're like, bam, one note, you know, is BB,
right?
You know?
Right.
You know what? It's kind of funny. You could inside's kind of a dense track, but it's cool. It's raining here today, so that's a song that I wrote. I actually reference it in the book. It's about after a trip I took to Cuba, called Havana Quiet is the piece, and it was after Fidel. We had arrived there 3 days after Fidel Castro had died, and I was, you know. They had banned all music for 9 days and mourning. It was, you know, it's all detailed in the book, but very, very strange, bizarre time to be in Cuba. But it was so stark to me how the art and music of that culture, of any culture that is repressed like that, and, you know, finds a way, you know? Creativity always finds a way through the, you know, I mean, go back to slavery. They're out there just singing their soul. And in any event, I bought a painting down there of a man holding an umbrella, silhouetted, and it had rain all on the inside of this guy. was like, it was just raindrops all in him. And he had an umbrella, but he couldn't, there's no way he can get out of the rain if the raindrops are on the inside. So I ended up writing this song as a poem. Was not expecting to be a song. Started as a poem, and then I later made it into a song. So that's called Inside. So that's kind of tied in.
So you said you don't have a lot of journals, but some of the recall of some of the little details, I'm thinking,
I don't know. I don't know how I can remember that shit either. I really don't, man. I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday. But I can remember these really glowing details of some of these early days. It's funny. It's very similar to, well, the Suzuki method that I grew up is an ear training thing. So you don't learn from the page. I guess this is indirectly related to what we're talking about. But for some reason, when I pick up a cello, which I never do, I don't even own a cello, I can remember these early songs from like when I was, 12 years old. It's some kind of weird encoded thing. It's selective memory, I guess you'd call it. But yeah, I don't know. Some of the stories in the book are so outlandish and funny that I've been telling these tales, through the years, to the bandmates or whoever, but I just never written them down.
Right.
Yeah.
The Suzuki method, this method, did your mom and dad teach you this? And could you explain it?
Yeah, it's Dr. Suzuki is a Japanese music teacher. And it's set up into, I think there's 10 books for violin. I think there's 7 or 8 books for cello. And it's all... Most, at least in the beginning stages, is all learned by ear. So you're not reading notes off the page. So for it, you start off with Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. That's the first song in every book. And then there's variations of that theme rhythmically. They'll have, And what happens is we would play the tapes or records as you go to sleep or during the day, and you hear these things in your subconscious, right? So when you go to play them, the way it's supposed to, the melody, how it's supposed to sound. So you're not tied to this line, these lines on a page.
Right.
So I think it's a really beautiful way to learn music.
Huh.
It's definitely helped me through the years because I play a lot by ear, a lot by feel. I'm not a surgeon with music theory. In the same breath, I will say sometimes it can be inhibiting because you haven't learned that other side. It's all about balance in anything you do.
This Suzuki method thing is really cool. Some days I'll just play, and I love the Wood Brothers. So I've got a couple of I'll slow down.
Yeah, me too.
I'll slow down Oliver and freeze it, and I'll be like, what the hell chord is that? And he's got this, and he's like this.
Yeah, he's got this, he's got some chords. Yeah.
So this is just, should I be just frickin' play the guitar? Like, what do you think I should do?
I mean, it's always good to know a little bit more than you do on anything. Yeah, man, it's all about the feel. It's all about the way it feels. It's like people don't want to hear math. They want to hear music, you know.
A giver, well, love is a thief. Well, love will pick you up and then let you bleed. It'll seem like an old friend, then leave you like an orphan in the cold. Well, I've done the hurting, there were times I've been untrue. Had my share of being played a fool, baby. I understand things don't always go to plan the way you wish they would. When that cold wind starts to blow, no, you never got to be.
Beautiful music of Seth Walker. That's a lot of soul. This is Call My Name off his Gotta Get Back album, released in 2018.
Try a little forgiveness, and you might see yourself in a brand new light. When that cold wind starts, just call my name.
it feels like sacrilege to talk over any of Seth Walker's music. So if you want to hear these incredible songs of Seth's and any of his 10 albums in their entirety, start off by heading to sethwalker.com. I'll provide links for where you can buy Seth's music in the liner notes of this episode, and I'll also list each song we've played in today's episode. The soul of Seth Walker, musician, singer, songwriter, guitar player, author, poet, painter, man of wisdom. Seth's book, Your Van is on Fire, is a damn good read. I loved it. I recommend it for especially any aspiring musicians, but for that matter, anyone who is breathing. Thank you to Kevin Calabro of Calabro Music Media for introducing me to Seth, and a special thanks to Seth for taking the time out of your day, that rainy day in Nashville, which inspired your song Inside when you were in Cuba, and that rain perhaps was the tonic necessary to get you to go so deep in this excellent, insightful interview. I'm deeply honored. Thank you for taking the time. In the notes of the episode, I'm also going to post a short video link from our conversation where Seth showed me his favorite two guitars. On video, you can see them, and if you're into guitars at all, or beautiful pieces of art, you will surely drool. Thank you for listening to The Happiness Quotient. Thank you to the Wood Brothers for their gracious permission for the use of their song, Happiness Jones, as our theme music.
All of my wisdom came from all the toughest days. I never learned a thing being happy.
If you'd like a free downloadable PDF of The Happiness Quotient, A Course in Happiness, visit me at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, or head over to eyesopenproductions.com/happiness.
Jones, my friend, Happiness Jones.
For more information about me, to inquire about personal coaching or public speaking in person or online, eyesopenproductions.com. Look for the word contact at the top. Click it. Boom. Please, my friends, share this episode with anyone that might find these words inspiring. I rely on the kindness of the listeners to share and distribute these episodes. Set your mind to things of good intent. Even though the search can be dark and deep, something bright does await us, even in this tragedy that we call life. Thank you for visiting The Happiness Quotient. I will see you all real soon.
The happy, 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 happiness zone. A happy, 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 happiness zone. Yeah, happy, 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 happiness zone. And I'm not sick. I'm not alone. Well, we all got it. A happiness zone. Words I wrote in the storm to rock my boat. All that was stuck in my throat when I was happy. And all of those songs I was singing, hey, while my boat was sinking. And next thing I'm thinking, I'm happy. I might as well change my name.
to Happiness Jones, my friend. Happiness Jones.